Who will protect us from our protectors? Who shall judge our police? Who will redirect our directors and who release our release? Who will police our judges and who will our will? He who chooses his slavery, is he a slave still? Out of paradoxes, man creates his world. He cannot clean his socks and says, the world is soiled. We are only playboys in the house of the dead. Very few poems get written. Fewer still get read. Who will police our judges? And who will our will? He who chooses his slavery, is he a slave still?
Hello, listeners. This is David Blakeslee. Welcome you to a very special 75th episode of the Criterion Reflections podcast, in which I and a couple friends are going to be discussing W.R. Mysteries of the Organism, directed by Dujin Makaveyev in 1971. And I guess we're in for a bit of a trip here, guys, because we've got a very experiential, intense, in-your-face encounter of a film. One that I don't want to just trivialize with the minutiae of when it was made and how it was made and the cinematography and all that stuff, even though it's fun to talk about that. But I really want to engage with it on that very primal level, and I think I've got a couple guys who are up to the challenge. So first, let's welcome Derek Power. Derek, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, all things considering.
Yeah, of course, we're all hunkered down and doing this in extraordinary circumstances. I'm sure that will also color our conversation as we are in week whatever it is of the global pandemic here on April 4th, 2020, if you want to know the specific date and time of this recording. And then rejoining me after way too many months away is Brad McDermott. Brad, hello, hello.
Hello, hello. It's good to be back.
It is very good to have you. And, you know, you kind of keep us international, taking Richard Doyle's place up there in Toronto. So we are a multinational podcast, a conversation that spans the borders. How you been doing, Brad?
I'm in the same boat as the rest of you. I'm just sort of hunkered down in my apartment and, a lot of movies, a lot of TV shows to watch. And I can work from home now, so I am very happy and fortunate that I minimize how much that I have to leave the apartment. So yeah, I'm just kind of doing my part.
And I appreciate the frequent updates that you and Fred give us on social media there. Oh. Very amusing. So little insider joke there. But yeah, what's not an insider joke, what's a very outsider, touch it, feel it, let it get in you and take you where the mind wanders type of film is this one here. W.R. Wilhelm Reich, World Revolution, Mysteries of the Organism, or is it the orgasm, or is it the industrial military complex? I don't know. We're going to have to figure all that out. Guys, as I've already said in some of our pre-show chatter, my brain is bursting with thoughts and impressions and directions this could go. And I'm willing to take the lead, but I also just want to give you guys a chance to, weigh in. What drew you to this particular episode? None of us, I'm sure, ever imagined we'd be talking about this film under the kind of conditions culturally that we're at right now, but what an amazing experience and interplay of ideas it is. Derek, what drew you to want to talk about this movie?
That's funny because I'm trying to remember how the hell I jumped into this. I think it was because... it was a title that was, it just basically gave me an excuse to watch the title. And I think I signed up for it way before I even subscribed to the Criterion channel, which has it available there. So, I had seen someone do a review of it. But it had been a long time since I last seen it. So I had completely forgotten about what it exactly had covered. So revisiting that review, revisiting this film, and it was like, boy, okay, there's a lot there. And it definitely hit some buttons for me personally, which is good, which I'm very sure we'll talk over the course of this. So
if this movie doesn't push your buttons, I don't know.
Right, it's doing something will. Wrong.
Yeah, well, I mean, this it just addresses so many core issues. Brad, tell me about your interest and maybe even your familiarity with Makaveyev and his work.
Well, I mean, I signed up for this podcast because I have always been a big fan of this film since I saw it. When I first moved to Toronto over 10 years ago, I think I rented it on VHS from Suspect Video. But I only had heard about it since, I think that's when Criterion had announced that it was like an upcoming release. So I'm like, what is this curious movie? And I keep hearing it. You know, it sort of has this reputation as being one of the titles in the collection that's very much like on the sort of blinding edge of taste and things people will tolerate and that kind of. And I'm always curious and sort of drawn to that material. So
yeah. Where is the frontier? You know, how far can it go? Right.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And also it's accompanying title Sweet Movie. Both of them together. So I've seen both of these movies. I own both of these movies, and I always feel sort of passionate about defending the films that can be attacked more easily, I think, than others. So yeah, I guess that's my history with this one.
Well, that's great. And have you seen any of his earlier films, the films in the Eclipse series set?
No, I still have to get through the Eclipse titles and also his films afterwards. I've only seen this in Sweet Movie, unfortunately. It's the rest is sort of a hole that I have to venture down.
No problem, and no need to make apologies for that, because you know the route that people take to experience this film is part of the interesting journey. Like I've been following Makaveyev throughout his career. Obviously, I've written about and talked about that Eclipse series set many times. I've written individual essays. I've reblogged about it. Done episodes, and you can see so many threads of each of those earlier films kind of coming to a full fruition here. But again, my interest is really in just talking about what is this film fundamentally presenting to viewers in its immediacy, the body language, if you will, that the tactile, the effect that it has if you view it with eyes of empathy, how it affects our own breath, our own pulse, our own thoughts about ourselves, our own personal stories, our sexuality, where we're at just in life in general. This is a film that touches at that deepest core level so many aspects about life as an experience, as a phenomenon. And that's kind of what I'm really interested in kind of exploring. Maybe even making this podcast as much of an encounter or as a challenge or a spontaneous experiment as seemed to be happening in many aspects in the making of this film. So, who wants to jump off that little platform I've given you here? I mean, you know, there are the scatological elements, the shocking graphic depictions of sexuality. Those are probably some of the things that got it a lot of attention. It was very frank. It was very bold. It was very uncompromising in its time. It's probably been surpassed in so many ways by the media and the times that we live in now. But it's still the way it's presented here, in the context of this very intellectual, very sophisticated argument, which is both hilariously profane, but also somber and humanistic and incredibly thought-provoking. Just, yeah. Just wondering, how do you grab onto it? What do you grab onto as the initial point of departure as we try to grapple with what WR is telling us?
Well, I think this is a film designed to present ideas and maybe in a sense be a kind of way of looking back at a certain point, as well as being sort of unintentionally a time capsule for that particular instance. So I think it's probably best to do it that way. Mm-hmm. For me personally, like I said, this hit some buttons with me because, in two big ways. One is the sex, and particularly having the sex being the basis of your entire worldview. Mm-hmm. That's something that I don't agree with. And then the other is the politics, especially with the, I guess you could call like the main story or the,
well, which one? It's like, yeah.
Yeah. Which one?
It's a collage. Go ahead.
Yeah. I guess I could call it the sort of, weird sex sitcom plot, involving mm-hmm. Melina and
the skater,
apartment complex and everybody getting their rocks off in there or trying to get their rocks off and such. But yeah, the politics in there, I also don't agree with. Like I can't stand Marx at all. And he just gets more distasteful for me as time goes on. So that's definitely the buttons that it pushes, but I will give the film, and I want to make this clear that I'm not saying that I'm definitely not one to say that this film shouldn't have been made. I think I've always been a champion of films that dare to do things differently or that seem very atypical, even if I don't agree with it. I'm not going to get in the way of what saying something. And it's because if you present something in a honest and straightforward way, then it's a way of dealing with it. I rather deal with stuff head on rather than trying to deal with euphemisms or trying to soften the blow or something, because it doesn't make for honest discussion. I think you have to be a bit provocative and confrontational in order to get the best ideas out, and hopefully we'll come out of this better people, all of us. So, but it has to start with something very honest and straightforward. So I'm not faulting the film for that. It's just the ideas that are presented, I disagree with, and I want to make that very, very clear from the onset.
You've done that. Let's go ahead and get Brad's input here.
If I could sort of argue against that a little bit. I don't necessarily think that this film is taking Marx's argument 100%. If anything, this film is taking Wilhelm Reich's argument 100%. Both
I would agree.
Both Reich, both the story of Melina, both Makaveyev, and also to a maybe lesser, maybe more unclear extent, what's the magazine in New York? Them
Screw.
Screw, and also the beatnik actor.
Tule Kupferberg, the Fugs, right.
Mm-hmm. Right, he doesn't really connect those specifically right with Reich, but I always take the position that all of these very strident different stories are from the same perspective, and I think it's
he's integrating right. He's synthesizing these juxtapositions. I don't know that there's even a strictly Reichian ideology here. I mean, it's made in his honor and certainly respecting his voice, but I'm not sure he would even. I would even go so far as to say that this is a 100% endorsement of Reichian theory. Either it's sort of putting the ideas out there to be considered but they're going to be as fallible and as, you know, self-contradictory when put to the test as any other ideology that's out there. That's kind of how I see it. I mean, the film starts with this very affirming message. It's almost like a live, laugh, love type of a prologue there, you know? It really is. And then it ends on this note of real tranquility and reconciliation, but only after extraordinary, unbelievable things have transpired in the middle, you know?
Right.
With the skater singing the hymn, with the, you know, huddled around the fire with the gypsies. And that's kind of like life has gotten back down to its very basics, just each other's companionship, doing what we can, having learned what life has had to teach us, and moving forward into the new day. I mean, that's basically where the film winds up. But what a journey it is to get us there. And that's, to me, where this... The profound beauty and the emotional resonance of this film really is to be found. It's so easy to focus on the outrageousness of it all, or the, you know, to a lot of people, unprecedented frankness with which a lot of these issues are being addressed. But to me, it's like, wow, what a wonderful exploitation of the gift that cinema is to be able to touch people at that level. Even to get past our easily scandalized surfaces to say, wow, there's something really deep going on here. And then even getting into the geopolitical stuff, the West versus the Soviet bloc, and then Yugoslavia's unique role in the middle of all that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead, Brad.
Oh, I was just going to say, too, again, sort of if to bring us to Marx, like, I think that, you know, the villains in this film, like, are Stalin and the communist regime. And also on the West, I would think that the villains is capitalism and its belief that sort of buying things will make us all happy. Like I just think that there's a much wider net that Makeyev is sort of casting as to who are the heroes of this story, who are the villains, between East and the West, between sexuality and communist/fascist/capitalist, mm-hmm. that everything is sort of this sort of gray area, and our own politics will register somewhere within this film just because he is casting that super wide net. So that's one of the many things I love about what he does here.
Yeah, there's a very subjective element. No viewer can escape, you know, their own frame of reference. And how do you encounter this? Yeah, like you say, both of you have said that this is going to, you know, present some points of agreement where we say, oh, this is kind of where I find myself as a character in this strange kaleidoscopic phantasmagoria, but there's my little point of connection. And then there are other parts which seem very alien and foreign and you know, kind of confrontational to us because they challenge our beliefs, our upbringing, what we think is right and wrong, what's decent, what's immoral, and just, you know, how should people be treated? What do I deserve? What do other people deserve? I mean, we see, you know, depictions of, you know, terrible cruelty to, you know, people who are, you know, mentally handicapped, and state-sponsored torture. But there's also, you know, simple joys of life and living and the dialectic of all the, you know, arguments and conflicts, the battle of the sexes, if you will, love and eros and hatred and rivalry. I mean, it's all right there. So many dimensions to explore.
Definitely.
Yeah, like I say,
the eternal question: where do we keep going?
I know, well, it's kind of like all over the place,
and that's okay. Maybe I'll have to do some editing miracles to make this listenable here. But as I've been kind of cycling the movie throughout the day, and again, just really enjoying it. I feel like its stature has been enhanced as I've kind of really understood what Makeyev did here. He he had a story that he conceived of, I think, in Serbia, Yugoslavia, where he lived. But then he had an opportunity to go to New York City and to do this background research on Wilhelm Reich. I think that was what brought him to the States.
Yeah, he received a Ford Foundation grant.
And, right, right.
Because he wanted to do a documentary on sort of the legacy of Wilhelm Reich. That mm-hmm. brought him to the like New England, is it Maine? I think the,
yeah.
that
yeah.
area.
Right, yep. Rangeley, Maine.
Yeah.
Rangeley, yeah. Maine, I think is how you say it.
So yeah, so he had that kind of excuse, that premise to come to the USA to create this film, because you know he had been pretty much just making movies in his own territory up until then, but now he's had a chance to do something international. His reputation had already begun to escalate as he was winning film festival awards, and he was part of the, you know, kind of some of the new waves that were going on. The Yugoslav Black Wave, I guess, is what this particular movement is referred to. I don't know a whole lot more about it other than Makaveyev's films, and I've never really studied the movement as such, but I did get a pretty nice collection of links together for people who do want to study up on more on that. I'm really just a novice in terms of putting these films into a wider kind of Yugoslavian Serbo-Croatian context. I think I've learned a little bit over the years. But anyways, getting back to my earlier point, which was when he came to the United States to do this background research on Reich, he also wanted to sort of take a look at what was happening in New York City and in the kind of the cinema circles that he, you know, was getting known in there. And that's where he runs into, was it Jackie Curtis from the yep. Andy Warhol troupe?
Yes.
And Thule Kupferberg and the Fugs. And those were early points of connection for me as well. I recall as a child, my dad picked up an 8-track tape of the Fugs' second album called It Crawled Into My Hand, Honest. And I remember just growing up listening to this really weird collection of music. I think it had a pretty profound influence on me because I can remember those songs, you know, like they were childhood ditties, although some of them were pretty graphic and pretty crazy in their content. So, you know, all of a sudden I've got this kind of experiential, you know, early in life connection to the Fugs and Thule Kupferberg as this kind of master satirist, kind of this prankster, kind of bohemian type of guy running around in orange, kind of a decrepit uniform, massaging his submachine gun, doing some street theater and performance art to the consternation of some of the investors and you know, working class folks on the New York City's business district. I mean, yes, this is amazing happening. Go ahead.
I just think I watched that scene. I just rewatched this film yesterday. Yeah. And, you know, when I first saw this movie, like over 10 years ago, that scene plays in a different context. And just watching this movie again yesterday, that scene plays in a whole different context. I am surprised that that they both got away with that. Both do.
Yeah, open carry.
Like, I'm surprised he wasn't just shot on the street. Like, can you imagine nowadays? Yeah, exactly. Can you imagine nowadays someone right. running around the Lincoln Center with a submachine gun pointing it at suits and old ladies with their big hairs?
Oh, yeah.
And none of them, like, some of them look at him weirdly, but none of them are running for their lives. There's nothing besides, I'm assuming, Duchenne's camera pointing at him. Like, there's nothing to say that this isn't a real gun and that you aren't really in danger, you know? Like,
right.
It's kind of a miracle.
Well, it was the day of the yippies and protests and street theater, and I'm sure New York City had a lot of its, you know, provocateurs out there, especially when you've got even a small camera crew. People understand there's a bit of a put-on going on here, and they're happy to be part of the show. But it's still an incredibly defiant and aggressive lampoon of you know, uptight middle class values and everything that we're supposed to take seriously, at least in the Western side of the cultural equation here. If you're viewing this from a, you know, from the Eastern Bloc, from a, the, you know, somebody who's been raised to believe sincerely in, you know, communism and socialism, and you see all the, you know, the degradation and the depravity of Western culture, the insipid Coca-Cola ads and you own the sun and the sheer cheesy fakery of it all, you know, and the decadence that is being portrayed openly on the streets. I mean, if that's your frame of reference, then you're scandalized for all different reasons by what this movie's putting in front of you.
Yes, absolutely. I sorry.
So, well, what it is? I mean, so this movie is, it sort of feels like it's like this prism, you know? It's like this thing that you can just hold up from any different angle and see. Sometimes it's yourself reflected back in it. Sometimes it's the world turned upside down that you're going to have to grapple with and take seriously. And sometimes it's just shocking and funny and abrasive and just there to kind of blow your gasket a little bit.
I mean,
yeah, again, I think it's just a collection of various assertions, you know, like mm-hmm. like this is this and like everybody kind of has their say and like this, you know, this is what I believe or this is how things should be or whatever position you take, and you kind of have to just respond to it like, yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I agree with that. No, I definitely don't agree with this or mm-hmm. or whatever. So that's
what, or even is it, how important is it to agree or disagree? I mean, I even
right. Say, am just, I going to die just, on this hill for this?
Right. Yeah. Just consider it. Just live with it. Just inhabit it for a moment and then move on to the next thing.
And I mean, I think that like Jonathan Rosenbaum in his review coined the collage film mm-hmm. with what Mechavea was doing here. And I think that's a key to like how we're supposed to approach this film. Mechavea gives us so many strident themes and different ways of bringing them across, whether it's a propaganda in a Soviet film or, you know, a documentary footage on the Nazis torturing mental health patients, or a fictitious mm-hmm. version of a sort of a love affair going on in Belgrade, or and everything that's going on with Wilhelm Reich and everything that's going on in New York City. All these are so different, but like the whole purpose of editing this film this way is to for us to understand how interconnected everything is, and I feel that is sort of the grand message. I know.
Yes.
I know you had said that, you know, you don't, Derek, that you don't believe that sexuality is sort of your governing principle, but this is sort of the great big relationship between sexuality and politics, especially the more mm-hmm. like strident elements of communism and fascism and, you know, like deep capitalism that we see here. So he's always banging these sort of ideas off of each other, and he does it sort of in like a way reminiscent of like the Soviet montage, like Eisenstein, right? Like he's banging like the making of the silicon dildo sequence with Stalin's mm-hmm. arrival in the vow, saying we've completed the first stage of capitalism, that everyone said when we got rid of the bourgeoisie, we couldn't create anything new, and the thing, you know, the thing we just created that's new is a silicon penis. So like right. he's very much, and it's playful, right? His intent is to
it is very playful.
We want you to laugh along with mm-hmm. that. There's one element in the one sequence at the end of this film that really sort of puts a button on that idea to me. And I mean, it's in the climax, so I think it's like appropriate, because that's sort of when a film's at its like highest moment. Mm-hmm. But right after the figure skater tells this glorious story about Russian propaganda, you know, Soviet, all that stuff, and because they're out in the like the field with the little porch, and he's like on the porch, and he's getting really riled up with how passionate he is about Soviet communism, and she touches him, and Milena touches him, and then he slaps her to the ground, and we have a shot, reverse shot of Milena on the ground looking left, and then instead of him looking right, it cuts to Stalin, or rather the actor mm-hmm. playing Stalin from The Vow, crying. And he through that technique of like the director's line, the 180 line, where you where you just shoot, like when you have two people having a conversation, you're just shooting them from the one side. So that way,
right.
one character is looking left, the other is looking right, and we can infer they're having a conversation. Through using right. that cinematic technique, he is like forcing these two elements together as if they are one. And
yes.
And then that sequence carries on with more of the movie, The Vow, the propaganda film. But it's those sort of ideas of when he's using juxtaposition, when he's layering different music on top of different sequences, different speeches on top of different sequences, in and out, that he is connecting the idea of sexuality and politics together in this great big tapestry that I said we all have our spot on, right? But he mm-hmm. wants you to know how and why all of these things are connected, and they're important. That's important because we kind of want to put these things in boxes and think that they're not interconnected with each other, but they are.
Yeah, and then same coming to the sort of the critical analysis of a film like this. I mean, there are so many moments that are really, to me, just moments to be lived in, to be viscerally experiencing as the film is doing what it does visually, audio, and just how it resonates with our own emotions. It makes it very difficult to talk about it. You know, I mean, we can maybe try to, you know, meticulously analyze a few key moments here or there, but this really just feels like such an experiential process, this particular movie. It's not the way that Makaveyev stitched it together, because yeah, he had all these disparate elements, all these different things that could have been told as little mini documentaries or, you know, just mini segments all sort of lined up sequentially, but it's the way they interpenetrate each other which is what gives this film such incredible breath and vitality and rewatchability, because the combinations are so spontaneous and so fresh. I don't think they get tiresome, you know, or there's such a variety there that you don't always, oh, well, there's that moment. I mean, there probably are a few that become a little bit more known with repetitious viewing, but I just find myself experiencing so many, you know, insights and reactions that are pleasurable for the most part. I really enjoy watching this movie, but I also recognize I'm being taken into some pretty twisted avenues as well.
And again, I like engaging, and contrary to how I may come off, I like engaging with things that are contrary to, that may be contrary or I disagree with, because it helps me to articulate better, like, what is it that I really believe? What is it that I really mm-hmm. stand for? So that I don't have the sort of knee-jerk. It's very easy to have a knee-jerk reaction to something, but if you can kind of engage with what's there, and again, I applaud the film for just being brutally frank and honest in what it's showing, because then you can kind of treat it for what it is and say a certain degree of yes and no. I know it's not strictly binary like that, but definitely you can kind of have your own reaction and you know what you're reacting to, because everything is all there to see. Yeah. You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Brett, I wanted to kind of, what are your thoughts on this little polarity between Milena and Yogoda, the two female roommates? And yeah, it seems like Milena sure likes to talk about sexuality, and Yogoda's the one who's actually going about it. Any thoughts just on how you sort of saw those two characters play off each other?
I mean, I think Makaveyev is using them to sort of contrast, you know, what's being said with what's being practiced, right? The mm-hmm. the roommate is the more like sexual one, and the her rolling around with all these men is the visualization of everything that Milena is sort of preaching, and
yes.
and it's, well, again,
thinking about it or putting it in so many words,
right exactly, and it's again it's Makaveyev's attempt to sew sexuality and politics together, that these two things have a relationship with each other that can be symbolized in the relationship between these two women as roommates, and you know what they are doing during the film. One is just sort of enjoying openly her sexuality with many men, whereas the other seems to be more politically driven. She really wants to get to know the Russian figure skater, and she really wants to get closer to sort of the Russian idea of of communism. To I think in order to sexual. Yeah, in order to push Reich's ideas, because I mean she's a firm Reich believer, to push those ideas into the Stalinist, more Marxist Leninist kind of vision of communism, which had sort of sucked sexuality and free love out of the movement, not understanding that they are just that they can be part of that movement, right?
Yeah. Well, I really do encourage you, Brad, to check out the two particular his earliest films, "Man Is Not a Bird" and "Love Affair" in the case of the missing switchboard operator. Because, as I said earlier, both of those films are kind of like seeds that come to fruition here. In "Man Is Not a Bird," you have the same actress Milena Dravich, who I think is just unbelievably compelling and mesmerizing in her role. Can I just get some applause for her? Is she not extraordinary? She really is. I was just the way when she has to be intense and serious, she sells it completely. And of course, you know, she's beautiful and charming, but she takes on an extremely challenging role, and I think succeeds, you know, dramatically. Apparently she was one of the premier movie stars of Yugoslavia. Yugoslavian film in this era, so she certainly shows why. And in that film, she's a young a cosmetologist, actually very much reprising that first scene, who kind of scorns the local boys in favor of this visiting scientist who's boarding with her family. He's a kind of a VIP, and she has a love affair with him, that's, you know, kind of an awakening experience for her, but it's very comic and very interesting in the class dynamics there. And then with Love Affair, you get a little bit more of that tension between the Christian and the Muslim populations within Yugoslavia, and the way the state was kind of trying to synthesize and force those two cultures together. But both of those films, good luck, right? And Love Affair, the switchboard operator, that also has a pretty tragic, violent ending. So there's a lot of interesting parallels and ideas that Makavia has been playing with in the earlier films. You know, it's like I say, coming to play here, and it really does make a pretty fascinating, you know, arc if you want to just trace some of his storytelling elements, and also the use of documentary footage and all kinds of elements like that. I think he just kind of took to perfection at this particular stage of his career.
Actually, I should point out with the documentary portions, it reminds me very much of Maisel's, and also a little bit of Les Blank, where
kind of cinema verite.
Very much a mirror. Like this is this little particular world, and it's just kind of showing it as is without making any kind of judgments one way or the other. It's just like, this is what it is.
So. Right. But taking those little slices and putting into the context of other things, that's this little
Milan. That's very much him. Oh, yeah, definitely.
All right. What else do we got, folks? I mean, we don't have to belabor this. I feel like, we've meandered a bit, and
there's lots to talk about, but it's like you said, it's difficult to know because there's not any sort of like linear narrative that we can go through. Right. We sort of grab stuff. I wanted to talk about feminism in this film, and particularly female sexuality. The same thing. Edit that out. I wanted to talk about feminism in this film.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
In the Belgrade story, Milena, she very much says, death to male fascism. Freedom of female sexuality, I believe her line is. And then in her accusations against the Russian figure skater that she's admired, when she attacks him, Makaveyev is using her to, I think, sow the ideas that the Russian belief in, you know, overthrowing the bourgeoisie and we are for the people. Once again, this was an ideology that was patriarchal. This was for men only, and these ideas of freedom and revolution did not include women. They just sort of had to go along with what was going. And I really think that Makeyev is very clever in how he's contrasting that, but then also the West, where we have like a McCarthyism type of again men coming down on Wilhelm Reich, coming down on his beliefs of emancipating the orgasm, and particularly mm-hmm. we see examples of women achieving some sort of harmonious relationship with their own bodies in some of these.
Well, it's pretty
phrases.
Cathartic, honestly. I mean, their orgasms are screaming, bone shaking. But you get the sense of decades of pent up repression finally coming loose.
Right.
You know, that's the powerful message to me, is like, at long last, these women are having a chance to wake up, you know, and be recognized. So yeah, you hope for harmony and reconciliation at the end of it all, but right now they're in the throws of crisis, it seems. There's that one woman. You're right. You're the one woman who talks about how she feels very much at one. But she's a younger woman. Did you notice that?
Yes.
She's a younger woman who maybe hasn't had, you know, two or three decades of a crappy marriage to try to process in this moment of a final release.
And we have there's a few other examples too from the Western side of feminism. We have the artist who paints people masturbating, and
Betty Donson.
Yeah, and as sort of that she is able to express her sexuality through her her point of view, right? She is viewing these men. I think it's men and women. I'm not sure that she paints.
Yeah, it's both.
So she is expressing her own sexuality through her paint, through her eyes, through what she sees. And then we have Jackie Curtis, again, who tells an extraordinary story about a sexual relationship she had with an older gentleman when she presented as male. And later on, when she met him again and she presented as female, he didn't want anything to do with her. So, yeah. Makeyev is sowing all of these point of views of feminism in the West and feminism in the East, feminism under the rule of like capitalism and consumerism, feminism under the rule of communism and authoritarian, whatever that word is, you know what I mean? Fascism.
Yeah.
and contrasting
even the iconography, right?
Yeah, exactly.
When Jackie kind of takes on sort of this Madonna and child type of poses, like, you know, she's an icon, you know, so there's a spiritual dimension, even in the midst of this supposed depravity and kind of sleazy, you know, gutter life that she's living in Manhattan, 42nd Street, and the trashy cinemas and all of that kind of thing. So incredible, the deeper you go into it, the richer it becomes.
I agreed. We're next, guys.
Yeah.
Next.
What did you think about the opening poem? In fact, I think I probably will use that as the intro music rather than soundtrack. That who will police our police? Who will will our wills? That whole spoken word piece by Thule Kupferberg. I don't know if that was Ed Sanders or Thule Kupferberg, but they were kind of the two. Kind of main spokesman for the Fugs. Do either of you have any appreciation or a familiarity with their work at all?
Well, actually, when you were talking about the Fugs earlier, I had just remembered that CIA Man was the outro for Burn After Reading.
Okay, I didn't.
Plays during mm-hmm. that. So it's like, because when I saw this and I heard Thule's voice, like, where have I heard this? Where have I heard the Fugs? And then I just remembered, oh yeah, and then I confirmed it later with IMDb. So okay.
Yeah. No, they were just kind of this really obscure but pretty provocative and really spot on, you know, the whole Kill for Peace, which is, I guess, probably gonna be my outro music. This right. anthem, you know, the more students we get rid of, the better things will be, from the perspective of this uptight middle class business owner or, manager or whoever he is, wanting to go back to his tranquility, just to watch his Westerns on TV and not be disturbed by reports of rioting in the streets and things of that sort. It's kind of, to me, very, very amusing to see this kind of biting critique of American culture from an outsider who comes right into our own territory and says, okay, I'm going to stick it to you a little bit here and nail it too. I think he's not, shooting and missing. I think he's hitting his target.
It's so provocative that it's difficult to even know if it's satire or not. Like, unless you know that it's satire, it could almost be construed as, a chant of the alt-right, men's rights movements, all that kind of stuff. Like when he says, I'm going to kill myself over your dead body if you fuck anybody but me, is like, that's a men's rights anthem if I ever heard one. But unless
that's basically right. John Wayne's ethos right there.
Yes. And unless you
strip down to its bare basics.
Yeah. And unless you know that he's doing it in satire, you there's nothing to tell you otherwise. And I think that's a testament to how sort of black the humor in this film is.
Yeah, and that there's definitely more than a grain of truth to this. This is a reality that a lot of people live under and function under without blinking one ironic eyelash about it, So they're just bringing it out there. Obviously, the crowd that's most likely to see this film maybe doesn't identify with that ethos quite as severely, but we all know somebody who does. And maybe there's parts of that reside within our own psyche that we've got to, root out and deal with too.
Right.
Oh boy. Let me see. I don't know. I feel like we could just the juxtaposition, what was that, where where it cuts to the crowds of Chairman Mao and Red Square and
I love that part. When she's dancing.
Right. She's just given her kind of kind of stirring, inspire the troops.
Tribute to the orgasm.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And all the substitutes that we find, the athletic, the cerebral,
I love
the
that
mystical. I mean, it's just like that really was part of her performance. It just completely nailed me. And then as she's, and the thing that they're really doing this, that she's really, having this experience of all these people dancing around this apartment complex. What an incredible scene that had to have been to film that and just be part of that, And she is leading this massive procession. And then the next thing jump cuts right to Chairman Mao and his seething hordes. And again, let's talk about the context that we're watching this in right now. Just look at all those people smashed together in the middle of Red Square how are we living right now, there's probably the least amount of sex happening on the planet in any of our lifetime at this particular moment, right?
And what's brilliant is how he's just using cinematic technique. That would be a match cut, right? When her in a line along a balcony is match cutted with Mao and his sort of underlings also on a balcony overlooking his audience, his crowds. So again, he's
and this is all sort of orthodox doctrinal Stalinism, communism, socialism. This is all good stuff. This isn't supposed to be laughed at or sneered at or looked down upon. This is straight from the party, right?
Right. Right. The propagandic films that we're supposed to believe in completely, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right.
At least a certain portion of his audience, another portion is going to say, oh boy, look at those brainwashed people over there without realizing that those Coke ads and Coppertone ads are brainwashing us in their own insidious way.
And here he's also sowing the idea, she just delivered this great big speech in this courtyard, presumably presumably Stalin had just delivered, and are quite used to delivering big speeches in front of their crowds. He's sewing those ideas together again just through ingenious editing.
And also Milena very consciously, she's a sexy spokesperson. I mean, she's very cute in her little get up there, her jacket and her hat and her boots and her little mini skirt there, reaching for the camera. I mean, it's a very bravura you know, presentation of herself, using the assets that she has at her disposal to sell the message and to bring us on board. And I think, again, Makaveyev is very consciously capturing that. He knows how to, you know, present a visually appealing package that takes advantage of the emotions that those images are intended to stir up in us. Even the images of Stalin, you know, as you think about the gravity of his purpose and the responsibilities that he must shoulder for us all, it's just
right.
Yeah, it's kind of appalling, but amazing just to have it all put right there on the screen in front of us.
But it's
I was gonna say go ahead.
I was just gonna add to that real quick that it's not done without a great deal of humor, and that's what sells it. That's what there was one article you had linked us to where it said Eisenstein wanted 2 + 2 = 5, but only Makaveyev understood that you needed humor to make that work. And and I think that is exactly what you're getting at there, that he knew in order to sell these ideas and marry them together, you had to have the audience laugh. Otherwise, they're just going to think it's like pretentious, right?
Yeah. Well, what you know, obviously we always talk about these films in the context of their time. So this is 1971. This won the Louis Bunuel Award at the Cannes Film Festival that year. I would even say Makaveyev was making it almost specifically for that audience, or maybe with this kind of an outcome in mind, because he had won some smaller festival awards. This just feels like, I think maybe Derek, you had said earlier, kind of a time capsule of its era, and it absolutely is. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine some of the, you know, kind of the gestalt therapies and the, you know, all the groaning and moaning and
the scream
shaking
therapy
and quaking, all of that stuff. Yeah. You know, having this many people participating. I mean, look at the size of these groups. Are like, there's like dozens, if not hundreds, of people all having these really intense encounters with each other. I don't think that's happening on that scale these days. Maybe I'm missing something though.
Well, I mean, that's something that I notice is that, you know, it's very informed by its time. And then, you know, you look to almost 50 years later and you're seeing some of the fruits of all that. And then you kind of wonder, and, you know, I'm kind of wondering if this is where it all started. And then you kind of see the outcomes on the longer term is that has it done more good or has it done more harm than good?
Well, yeah, and then you get into the whole, you know, debate over psychology and Freud, and is Freud a positive influence or was he malignant? You know, do we need to, you know, did Freud set us free from some of the hang-ups of the past, or no, do we now need to be set free from some of the dogmatism of Freud, you know?
Right.
Right. Or putting everything down to a, you know, very materialistic explanation that's all about, you know, different chemicals and things just kind of interacting with each other and taking the soul or the spirit out of it. You know, these debates kind of go on as well. And so, you know, Reich was a disciple of Freud in the early years, but then they went their own way. You know, Reich was, you know, very earthy and very organic and very focused on, you know, the body and sexual exploration and expression as a healthy aspect of human life rather than a, you know, pathological or neurotic element of our existence. I mean, I think for Freud, you know, to simplify it more than I maybe you should, but he saw sex as more of a problem, whereas Reich saw sex as an opportunity. Is that a fair distinction?
Yeah,
no, that seems fair.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. But I think, I mean, maybe I just take Reich's point of view a bit more than most, mm-hmm. but I mean, I think that the pursuit of sexual liberation is a good thing. Like, you know,
yeah,
you,
I think Makaveyev would like endorse that too.
Yeah, I agree. And if we're viewing this over a long time period, like over nowadays, we're looking back on when the times that this movie was made, and like, you know, the repressiveness of the 80s was all in there. And then a bit of a freedom in the 90s. We're seeing things turn a bit more conservative now. I just think that when I look at this film, some of the messages that it aspires to say about the relationships between sexuality and politics that I wish had were just consistent. Like, if it started here in when McAvey have made this film and just kept consistent through the 80s, through the 90s, and just would keep progressing. I mean, I understand that politics is like a pendulum, but, you know,
cultures go through cycles and all of that.
Right. But I mean, and maybe this is me personally, just as a out gay man, sexual freedom is very important to me and how I envision what growing up would be like if I had grown up something like in the 70s as opposed to in the 80s, that if that progressiveness mm-hmm. that Wilhelm Reich and Duchenne Maccabeic and Milana espouse in this film had been consistent throughout the decades, would my, you know, sexuality, the story of my sexuality have been different? And I can't imagine, you know, mm-hmm. I mm-hmm. think that that's true for a lot of people my age.
Yeah, you know? Gay or straight or whatever. Yeah, exactly. I mean, but you're right. Yeah. You know, what about, let's talk a little bit about the male archetypes here. We've got the kind of the hairy, sweaty, greasy guys, and then there's Mr. Immaculate, you know, body toned to perfection, the figure skater. But he's a bit...
straight from a social realist poster, too.
Right.
He has the jawline for it.
Well, the fact is, he has worked himself into a very impressive, you know, specimen. Yes. He's got it going on. He's trained. He's muscular. He's athletic. He can make the show happen. That is nothing to be, you know, sneezed at or just kind of tossed aside. But he is also, you know, somewhat impotent and maybe out of touch with the, you know, possibilities that his own physique presents, because he's been so channeled into being an organ of the state.
And he, I mean,
double entendre intended there.
He's also like a misogynist too. That's the downside all of this, that he's been fed, you know, all of the lines about his male superiority and just dominance over women, and he can just do with what he mm-hmm. likes with whom he wants to, and you know, and that tragically plays out in the ending when he murders her.
Right, and that mentality, that's belief in his own supremacy, both on the terms of gender, his culture, his politics, his race, all of that is what, you know, is part of the package that brings him to this state of, you know, near perfection on a physical level, and yet it's got, you know, toxic poison within it, because he realizes that he's lost something in the bargain as well. And that's, again, you know, where that reconciliation moment comes at the end. Even though he's still literally got blood on his hands, he's trying to, you know, somehow put something behind him, reestablish some sense of communion between him and nature, even though a horrible price had to be paid. And then, of course, we get Milena's smile from the tray. Followed by Wilhelm Reich as the final image that we see there. Just unbelievable.
Which I have to point out that seeing Milena in the tray, I could not stop and think of the classic B movie, The Brain That Wouldn't Die, which would be spoofed by Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Sure. What were you going to say?
I was going to say he superimposes Milena with Wilhelm Reich right there. So, there's any confusion over the fact that they're speaking from the same voice, I think it's sort of eliminated with that final shot.
Right, and that's the synthesis that brings it all together, and kind of gives me the chills just thinking about how he took this incredibly crazy random collection of stuff, and to me brought it to a very truly an aesthetically beautiful and satisfying conclusion. It's pretty remarkable, a bit of filmmaking to say the least.
Agreed.
Yep.
All right, well, do we want to keep going on? We've got about an hour's worth of footage here to work with.
Got enough material to play with.
Yeah, you know, what do you guys just think as far as recommendations? Is this something that everybody needs to experience at least once in their lifetime, or any other kind of thoughts you have about where we go from here?
I don't have much time for people who are overly sensitive to images, people who get offended easily. I always find that offense says more about the person who's being offended than it actually does about the offender. So, in the spirit of that, I very much highly recommend people watch this film. And also, if you have a strong stomach, it's accompanied film Sweet Movie. Both films. both films.
It makes Sallow look like a Disney film.
But the thing with Sweet Movie, unlike Sallow is a very cold, intentionally so, it's a very cold film. Whereas Sweet Movie is not. Sweet Movie is very disgusting and very troubling in a lot of sequences. But it is always a celebration of sexuality and a condemnation of when politics intervene with sexuality or try to mess around with it or try to make it like find some sort of opportunistic way to use it for its advantage. And the same is true with WR. So they very much work as a pair. But I think that the way he uses the collage filmmaking is unique and inventive, and it is something that I wish had sort of kept going as much as it did. I like some films like Orson Welles' F for Fake, I'm thinking of, that really do a good job of sort of banging strident ideas together. And that film is sort of an essay film because it's his essay. He just reads it as a monologue. Rather than here, I think Duchenne is even a bit braver by smashing and stitching all of these disparate elements together and forcing you to extrapolate what he means by it. And it's a much more honest way because, you know, you're reaching these conclusions on your own rather than him saying, see, you know, what does it mean? This is what I'm saying when I'm contrasting the Serbian fiddle music with him jerking off the, you know, assault rifle. It's like, he's not saying that so directly. It's like, what does that mean to you, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, Brett, I think I would know how you'd answer this question. So, Derek, I'm going to throw this one to you. What would you say to critics who maybe thought even then in 71 or now that he's just kind of wallowing in filth and outrage for its own sake? He's playing to the cheap seats. He's being sensationalist and manipulative and, you know, naughty for, you know, just for the sake of seeing what I can get away with.
No, I definitely don't see him as a mere sensationalist or very surface. I think there's definitely some like a deeper drive going on that he's presenting ideas. So it's much more intellectual. And I think if you are willing to engage intellectually with the film, I would recommend it. But if you find yourself reacting to viscerally, just right off the bat and just outright dismiss it, then it's probably going to be a waste of your time. But if you have a taste or at least certainly an openness to provocative films that do more than just provoke, it's not there merely just to push buttons, but it's also to engage with things, to make you think about things and so forth, then I would recommend certainly once. If you don't see it again, then that's just your call. But
cross off your list at least. Yeah.
Well, you've seen it. Okay, that's it, and that you can kind of move on. But yeah. So that's my take on it, or my recommendation for it.
Excellent. Well, guys, any last little bits here? I think we're pretty well into our time limit here, but. Yeah, like I say, there's still more. Maybe I'll record some extra bits, or we can continue the conversation in the comments. I do hope that this is a film that people can engage in. Maybe just your thoughts again. The visceral physical intensity of this film, and this in this period of social isolation where people are really literally distant from each other, not able to get together in groups. How did watching this film, this very earthy, sweaty bodies bumping up against each other type of movie, affect you? To me, it was really kind of unsettling, just to realize how much we've lost for who knows how long. And it's obviously it's an adjustment that everybody's making, but it's really a very profound disruption to the social order that we're all living through here. And even watching this film or talking about it, I thought, boy, you know, there's a lot of real suffering going on right now. There's a lot of real deep hardship that people are feeling at all different levels. And so I certainly don't want to come across as I'm making light of that. There's a part of me that feels that this is a little bit indulgent doing podcasting, but I do hope that the conversation brings a little bit of insight and, you know, enlightenment into your day, wherever and whenever you decide to listen to us talking about this movie. Any other thoughts? I mean, Brad, what do you think about just watching the film in our current circumstances?
I mean, I would say that this is a great example of why we are doing this. You know, why is it so important that we social distance so that we can return to, like, the positive sexual experiences that this film, I mean, for the most part, portrays.
Or at least points us towards.
You know, absolutely. The philosophies of Wilhelm Reich and how they relate to sexuality were positive and were, they were freeing. And, you know, we want to return to those days. When we can all be sluts, in other words, but no.
But, well, it is. I mean, it really is. I mean, yes. the depth of these ideas really does. It does really resonate with me as I'm kind of thinking through what Reich had to say, what Makaveyev had to say, and what we've had to say for each other. So, Brad and Derek, I really appreciate your companionship with me over this past hour as we've kind of tried to decipher the indecipherable in some ways, but I really appreciate each of your responses to this film and your willingness to spend a little bit of time with me, you know, sorting through it all.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, David.
All right, guys. Well, we're going to be coming back soon. I think I've got another episode. I'm going to be talking about Shaft with Richard Doyle, one of the recent Criterion Channel entries. Thinking of Richard Roundtree in that role as a fashion icon of the early 70s. So that's Criterion's reason for putting it on the channel, and we'll be talking about Shaft and a whole lot of other things around that film very soon. So thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be talking to you soon. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.
It's mine, mine, give it to me, give it to me.
Зеленоглазый мой, пока земля еще вертится, и это ей странно самой, пока еще хватает времени и огня. Даже ты все понемногу
и не забудь про меня. Дай же ты всем понемногу, и не забудь про меня. Дай же ты всем понемногу, и не забудь про меня.